The Amazing Life and Work of John J. Audubon.
He styled himself as the American woodsman. He wore buckskins, and he never went any place without bear grease in his hair. He knew how to market himself as well as his magnum opus, The Birds of America. And he combines this interest in taxonomy, in classification, in scientific precision, with his very intuitive feeling of wanting to animate the birds back to life, of animating them on the page so you as the viewer have the experience of what he saw.
That's curator and author Roberta Olson of the New York Historical Society. We talk with her about the book and exhibition, Audubon's Aviary, the original watercolors for the birds of America. Then America's kids are getting fat. We talk with Chaz Nielsen about Henry Gets Moving, a new children's book that hopes to change that.
I would like Henry to become the national icon for the fight against childhood obesity. I want to hear people on the streets and on playgrounds saying, "Get moving, Henry." You know, I want that to become a national slogan.
That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rihanna. John J. Audubon was one of the most colorful and fascinating figures in American history. The illegitimate child of a merchant marine captain, he was born on his father's sugar plantation in Haiti, moved to France as a child, and was given a superb classical education. Then he came to America and reinvented himself as a buckskin-wearing naturalist, ornithologist, and, above all, artist. He traveled throughout the new nation, documenting its abundant bird life in magnificent engravings that he sold on a subscription basis to an eager public. Audubon laid the basis for the American conservation movement that would arise around the turn of the next century, and he remains an inspiration to nature lovers and art lovers everywhere. The full collection of 435 watercolors Audubon prepared for his world-renowned work, The Birds of America, is housed in the New York Historical Society. This spring, the museum has put on the first of a series of exhibitions of the watercolors, along with other works by Audubon. It's called Audubon's Aviary, The Complete Flock. A richly illustrated book accompanies the exhibition, with text written by my guest, museum curator Roberta Olson. The book is as spectacular as the exhibit, and Olson's text is a delight to read. The book, Audubon's Aviary, The Original Watercolors for the Birds of America, is published by Skira Rizzoli. I spoke with Roberta Olson at the New York Historical Society on Central Park West. The exhibit can be seen until May 19th, so hurry up if you want to see it. Roberta Olson, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Delighted to be here. Thank you for inviting me, Francesca.
Well, this is a sumptuous book, Audubon's Aviary. There is none other really like it. Tell us a little bit about how you got involved in doing this book.
It is a long story. It goes back to 1989. When I was a guest curator here at the Historical Society. Of course, I had known Havel prints and the prints after Audubon's watercolors, but I had never seen original watercolors by him. And during that time, they were in the conservation lab being prepared for another smaller exhibition, and I got the real treat of looking at them. And I have literally never been the same since. And I couldn't believe what I saw in terms of the levels, the use of multimedia, the kinds of statements he was doing, and the pioneering work in the medium of watercolor. I've always loved drawings and watercolors. Then in 2000, I became the curator of drawings. I left my academic post and came back to perch here at the Historical Society because I thought they had such a great collection. And I had to start working with Audubon, and it has been my privilege to deal with these watercolors because we hold all 474 avian watercolors, including the 435 watercolor models for the 435 plates of the Havel engraved The Birds of America.
And how did it come that the New York Historical Society became the home for this incredible collection?
This is quite a story, as most things associated with the legendary Audubon. He is the most mesmerizing person. I like to call him the American Leonardo because he combines science and art and everything else. When he died, of course, Lucy, his soulmate, they were indeed lovebirds, was the keeper of the flame, and she kept all the watercolors together. Then in 1862, she approached the Society, which is New York's oldest museum, founded in 1804, to see whether we would be interested in buying them, because she was destitute at that point. Her two sons had died. There had been many economic reversals. And, of course, it was the height of the Civil War, and it was very difficult to buy such things. And at this time, the Metropolitan was founded in 1870, the American Museum of Natural History in 1859. But we were really the only art act on the block. And it was decided eventually in 1863 that by subscription, the Society would purchase the watercolors from her. And this was the way, of course, that Audubon sold his Birds of America through subscription. So that is how we obtained all 470 from Lucy. And then in 1962, the last watercolor model for the Birds of America, which had become separated, came back to us by a donation. And then three others flew in 1962 from the illustrator Clara Peck.
Wow. And explain by subscription, what does that mean?
Subscription was a way in the 19th century, especially when very lavish publications or projects were sold. People signed up to get installments of, shall we say, in this case, the prints that were hand-colored. And for Audubon, they were in groups of five, which in book terms were called fascicles. And you would pay for each one. And with Audubon, in every 6 weeks or 2 months, you'd receive a box. But he was a brilliant marketer. Unlike other ornithological treatises, where you had everything taxonomically ordered so that there would be maybe 60 seagulls, 40 sparrows, and you'd have, you know, months of sparrows if you got five of them together, and not, they're all wonderful, but I mean, that's not great. He decided he would market them as one large bird, one medium bird, and three small birds, because Audubon was the first person to show all his birds life size. Ornithologists had wanted to do this for a long time, but he was the very first person to do this. He was a brilliant marketer. And actually, what's really fascinating is that in the exhibition that we have that accompanies the book, which is a three-year exhibition, but will be highlighted in this particular one, when he was 18 years old and came to America, and he already had begun this because all his birds are life-size, from a huge barn owl, which was on very large paper, to a small purple martin.
Amazing. Now, he also has an amazing backstory. I mean, he was young when he came here, but he already had quite a life. A bit of a controversial figure as well. Tell us about his early life and also his love of birds that began in his childhood.
You never know all the answers to these questions, although, shall we say, they're shrouded in the mists, and there are many theories about things. And, for example, just this past year, I actually saw he doesn't have a birth certificate, saw the document in France that is still held by his heirs that is inscribed with his mother's name and said, Mademoiselle Jean Rabin, birth of a son. That is the birth certificate, and it's in the doctor's bill that he gave his father. Audubon was actually an illegitimate child, which in the late 18th century was quite a stigma and something that he battled against all his life and tried to overcome, but in some ways it made him. His father was a naval and merchant marine captain who was married, but as Audubon said, his one fault was that he had a wandering eye. And this was his mistress, Jean Rabin, who bore Audubon, and he was born in Saint-Domingue, today Haiti, on one of his father's sugar plantations. His father was really amazing. His father fought in the Revolutionary War on the American side, and in fact, his father supported Napoleon, but he also survived the terror along with Audubon. When Audubon went back to France, and his father eventually followed him with the slave rebellion that was brewing in Haiti, he went back to France, and under the terror, they were imprisoned. And in fact, we know that they, in the area that they were in, Nantes, which was a seaport and actually a capital for slavery, it was a terrible, terrible place for the terror, because they didn't just guillotine people. They chained people to barges in the Loire River by the hundreds and sank them. It was just devastating. He survived all of that, and certainly it made an impression on him. He was trained then as a gentleman. He was adopted. He was first called Jean Rabin after his mother. Then he was called Fougère Audubon, because you couldn't have Christian saint names. So he was called Fern Audubon, which Lucy later changed to La Forest, Franglaise. Then he was finally adopted by his stepmother, and he was named Jean-Jacques, after Jean-Jacques Rousseau, of course, the father, again, always percolating with ideas that eventually filtered down to Audubon. And it was his father who first lit the flame of looking at birds around the marshes in what is today called the Marais d'Audubon, outside of Nantes and their country villa in Couëron.
His love of science and of ornithology, though, was also married to an incredible artistic sense. Talk a little bit about the development of that.
Again, we are talking about something that's not really documented, but he says that he was exposed to his father's illustrations, quote-unquote, and I think we've come to believe that those are by Buffon, ornithological illustrations, and he definitely was born with an eye. Probably he was entered in the naval school to follow in his father's footsteps, and he probably did learn some kind of topographical drawing there, but he had mal de mer, seasickness, so of course he flunked out, okay? He failed at that, and he would have had drawing instruction at home, because that was part of the education of a well-bred young man or woman. If you had means from the time of Castiglione in the 16th century. He learned to play the flageolet, many instruments. He was taught dancing, all the proper things of a gentleman. We know that when he went back to France in 1805 to 1806, he had been sent in 1803 to America to avoid conscription into Napoleon's army. His father was smart, but he didn't have his eye on the economics of Mill Grove, which was the estate his father had purchased outside of Philadelphia. He was more interested in exploring the wildlife of America. He was interested in such things as bird banding, and he was actually the first person in America to study homing of birds. But he had a sense, and birds probably awoke this, of color and nature and loving it. And it might be traced back to Saint-Domingue, and probably a very, very spiritual link with birds. But to go back to your question about art, he claimed he learned and was a student of Jacques-Louis David, but he always said it in such a way that my master was David, meaning that he probably studied prints and possibly paintings of David, who was then the gold standard for art. And we know that he was in Nantes right before Audubon was there, so that must have been the local legend in Nantes that David is, you know, the top of the heap, and that you should study David. But he was really autodidactic, and that also probably freed him to be so experimental with his media, to go to places where other people haven't gone, to do things such as to invent collage long before Picasso and Braque, to really learn what media was about, and to devise his own methods that would work in the wilderness when he was on his rambles.
We're talking with Roberta Olsen, Roberta J.M. Olsen. She's the author of Audubon's Aviary. It's a magnificent book that has been published along with the first of three exhibitions by the New York Historical Society of the original watercolors of Audubon for the Birds of America. And it's out from Skira Rizzoli.
And what's been really interesting to me, because it is an adventure with JJA, Audubon is one of those icons of American history and art. Winslow Homer called him America's first great watercolorist. he's such an amazing person, and there's so much to learn about him, and it's so complicated. He was also a very gifted writer, and we can talk about that later, that people always accept only the surface. And for me, it was a great adventure to dive in all these years that I've been living with him and cataloging all of the watercolors to try to scratch below the surface to get to the real essential Audubon. And part of that is, where did he stand in the evolution of ornithological illustration? What were his contributions? What influenced him? Because he was like a sponge that sort of took in everything, but then when he spit it out, it was very different. And that's what's true of all great artists. And I kept asking myself, why can I always go back to Audubon and find other things in him? Why do we always see things? Why does he talk about great themes when he's dealing with birds, like life and death and the cycles in nature? Why do you always feel something for these birds, which you don't in other ornithological illustrations? And why does he? What does he do? Because he does exactly what great Baroque painters do. He does exactly what great artists do to really involve you. You become part of his watercolors. It's very different with the prints, but in the watercolors, you really do. And if you read his writings, you realize that he knew so much. I mean, he talks about Rembrandt. He talks about how Raphael drew things. And he talks about Hogarth, meaning he knew satire. He refers to the ideal head, the Testa Divina, meaning he knew Michelangelo's and the 16th century's obsession with this. I mean, he's incredibly literate. And then he does such things that he says he was entertained by, you know, the crowned heads of Europe and also the aristocracy. And he would go to country houses for long weekends in which he'd have to participate in all these huge 10-course dinners, but he'd also draw for them. And he talks about how he'd get up early in the morning before anybody else did, not only to draw birds, but before he went out at 4 in the morning to draw birds, he snuck down to look at things like the Titians.
Now, you say in this book, Audubon's Aviary, that John Jay Audubon combined the Enlightenment sensibility of the 18th century with the Romanticism of the 19th century. I wonder if you could explain what you mean by that.
The Enlightenment was obsessed with cataloging and in natural history with taxonomy, with Linnaeus's binomial system. And Audubon does pay heed to that, and he's obsessed with the fact of naming the birds. In the exhibition, we have three exotic birds, some European birds, but in the Birds for America, he is really putting the birds on the map. He's the Lewis and Clark, really, of American birds. Remember, when he came to America in 1803, it was only the East Coast, and he tried to push west as that was the very year of Lewis and Clark, by the way. He tried to push west with the expansion of the country, and he would always change on his watercolors, which makes them so exciting, the taxonomy, because he was also really, really obsessed with that. He actually had a translation of Linnaeus that he kept with him, which was one of his Bibles, as well as his copy of La Fontaine's Fables. Those are his two tools that never left his side wherever he went. And the romantic part is the part, I think, of the, he styled himself as the American woodsman. He wore buckskins, and he never went any place without bear grease in his hair. Andy Warhol would have loved him because he had more than 15 minutes of fame. He had decades of fame and still does. But he knew how to market himself as well as his magnum opus, The Birds of America. He was a marketer, and he combines this interest in taxonomy, in classification, in scientific precision, with his very intuitive feeling of wanting to animate the birds back to life, of animating them on the page so you as the viewer have the experience of what he saw, what he saw embedded in the swamps, what he heard in the canopies of the trees. Because in his writings, too, he always does the phonetic calls. He dissected his birds. He learned everything about them. He also tasted them. Some tasted like ants. He'd tell you which ones were more tasty and why. But he was intent on classifying, and he was actually willing to change things. And that's what we learned through the watercolors. As science progressed, so did Audubon with his taxonomy. But the romanticism comes from the, I think, from the art and making things larger than life. He takes his embedded observations And he really makes them cinematic. For example, I think that he would have been a Steven Spielberg today. He would have been involved with movies. And he brings that pre-cinematic sensitivity to his work because you see all the potential movements of the birds. For instance, if you think of the flamingo, you see it walking, you see it feeding, you see it at going off the page. Many of his birds, you look at them and you hear the wings, like the parakeets, the extinct Carolina parakeets, you hear the cockleburrs rustling, and you expect if you blink that they will all have flown away and you'll have a tree.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm thinking of some of the magnificent plates that are in this book, Audubon's Aviary, and that express exactly what you're talking about here. For example, and I wonder if we could possibly open to it, and that is the northern bobwhite and red-shouldered hawk. It's on page 195.
That's Cecil B. DeMille multiplied by Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's an amazing drama that we see here. I'm going to ask you to describe this.
It's absolutely explosive. And what it is it shows and you really feel for this red-shouldered hawk. It's a juvenile, and it is the only watercolor and plate of Havel in which the prey is the major species, because he does the red-shouldered hawk in another watercolor. But what's happening is the northern bobwhites have this habit, and it's for self-preservation, of they go together, they put their heads together in a covey, and they sort of bond together, and then if something attacks them and it comes towards them, they scatter, and it confuses the predator, and in this case, the raptor, who is a juvenile. He doesn't know what to do. And Audubon shows him. He's putting on his brakes, okay? And you almost hear the skid marks in the air. And then you have all these northern bobwhites scattering around. Again, they're all different ages, and you can see the chaos and the confusion. And you're in it because you're on the same level as they are, and the hawk is coming down at you. So you identify with these bobwhites. But it's kind of comical, too. It's high tragedy, but in Audubon, there's always a comical element. And the bird, the red-shouldered hawk, looks out at you. The predator looks out at you. And that's another characteristic. He frequently has either the reserve of the paper or he scratches out the white in the eye. The eyes of the birds always engage the viewer. So you are really drawn into this high drama, this tableau of life and death again, the cycle of nature. But you know that this one's going to turn out just right because he's not going to get any of them. He's so confused. But he will learn. And you see, that is the whole idea. There are all these storylines, and it doesn't end just with a picture. And he encourages the viewer to go beyond and to complete it.
That's wonderful. You also say in this blending of the Enlightenment and Romanticism that Audubon actually influenced present-day environmentalists, whether they realize it or not. That was such an intriguing statement. I just have to ask you what you mean by that.
Well, Audubon himself, and people debate this, Audubon made people love nature so much and made people appreciate, again, this struggle that we see in nature. It's not always pretty. There are beautiful moments in it. There are uplifting moments just in life in general. And he made people appreciate that and want to conserve it. In fact, the National Audubon Society, which was incorporated in 1905, but was actually founded here in New York by George Bird Grinnell, speaking of name as destiny, who lived up near Audubon's estate of Minniesland on 155th Street and was tutored by Lucy when he was a child, began the Audubon Society in between 1886 and 1889. And that is sort of the most national manifestation of this. But Audubon himself was very conscious of conservation. And if you read his writings closely, and remember, it's all relative. You have to read them with a kind of historical filter on things, because what we think of as a conservationist now wouldn't have been then, because everybody hunted animals and birds for food. And as opposed to the old world, the new world had an endless supply, and some birds, like the passenger pigeon and the Carolina parakeets, were pests for farmers, and farmers would go out and shoot thousands of them in a week just because their crops were being destroyed. It was a very, very different world. But already in the 1820s, and Audubon started publishing here in America in 1824, and he then continued in England in 1826, already he made comments in the 20s about things disappearing, about the Carolina parakeets when he first saw them in 1808, how many there were, and how they seemed to be disappearing from our land. And then when he went to England, he would talk about things like how strange it was that people had to import to their estate animals and birds and had to have gamekeepers to sort of keep things up, where there was an endless supply in America in the Edenic wilderness that we had here. And he thought it was not the proper thing. He thought it was manufactured, and he was upset by that the Europeans, that he sort of called it the industrial waste, had come in and sort of taken away nature and the raw. And as he matured, there are more instances of this. He begins to reflect. Of course, we know he always preferred to draw birds, as he said, from life. But in order to do what he did, he had to, the polite word is, harvest them, and he put them up on his position board and drew them the way he had observed them. But as he got older, he liked it less and less. He was more careful, actually. And when he came here in 1839 back to America after the completion of the Birds of America, and Robert Havel brought the copper plates as well as the watercolors back to America, and he staged his exhibition of the watercolors at the New York Lyceum of Natural History. There was no natural history museum per se here. It was founded in 1859. He wrote to Daniel Webster in 1841 and asked Daniel Webster, pled with Daniel Webster, to found a natural history museum with him as a director. Okay, and that he did this not just to put specimens in, but because he believed in conservation. And of course, we know that Teddy Roosevelt was very instrumental in the conservation movement. He was very influenced by Audubon, and he worked with George Bird Grinnell. So it's a big circle. It's a very complicated issue, but I'd say that it's the inspiration for an appreciation of nature that Audubon did, but he really was conscious of it. But there were no such things as conservation people really in the 18th century, although there was a beginning, a germ of its starting.
And Daniel Webster was then Secretary of State.
Yes, Daniel Webster was Secretary of State when he wrote to him in 1841.
So he really laid the foundation for what would later become the conservation movement, is what you're saying.
I am, and it's not a linear kind of development, but he did, and in a sense, he was predisposed to it, shall we say. He was avant la lettre. He was ahead of his time. And I think that's what's so wonderful about him. And I guess that comes from his artistic mode. But we have to always think about people, not with the criteria we have today for things, but during the time, what was it like? What were the factors? What were the burning issues?
We're talking with Roberta Olson about the book she authored. It's a companion volume to an exhibition at the New York Historical Society of Audubon's Aviary. It's called Audubon's Aviary, the original watercolors for the Birds of America, and this is the first year of a 3-year exhibition. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the exhibition as well. I had the privilege of coming here. I found it stunning. Talk a little bit about that.
You're very kind, and I'm so glad you were able to visit us and be in the aviary. It's called Audubon's Aviary, The Complete Flock. This year is part one. In 2014 will be part two, in 2015 part three. And part one of The Complete Flock is unique because we have borrowed Audubon's earliest birds, which really have never been studied before. And for the first time, you can see, starting in the early birds from 1803, you can trace Audubon's development, both as a scientist and as an artist, from his earliest drawings of American species, which are hung, which are dead, which he tries to animate because he did not know taxidermy at that point, and there were no models for him to draw in Philadelphia, through his development of watercolor, his introduction of watercolor, and to his beginning to do both sexes, juveniles, introduce narrative, and have a kind of thinking bird. So it's very exciting because you see this development. We also have 33 alternate models for the Birds of America, as well as a bunch of Audubonianna, that is documents, proofs, copper plates that Havel engraved, as well as impressions, and of course our wonderful Birds of America, the Double Elephant Folio series by Robert Havel, whose plates we turn every single week. Then the last component is something that hasn't been done before. Again, we have the first 35 fascicules. That is, remember those groups of five plates that were distributed every 2 months to 6 weeks. We have for the first time the watercolors hung in those groups, the first 35, so that you can understand Audubon's decisions. Why did he do the things he did? And with those 175, we have songs and calls that have been provided by Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and they are wonderful, and you could put in the number and you hear them. And then for the birds that are regrettably extinct, we thought it was very important to underline those, like the Carolina parakeets or the passenger pigeons. We have the genetic next of kin, and there's an explanation on the audio telling you what has been chosen and why. And I think that's very, very important to do. For the ivory-billed woodpecker, we have taken the sound from the 1935 Arthur Allen film that was made in the Singer Tract Swamp, the last known, positively, absolutely accepted sighting of the ivory-billed woodpecker. We have that call, and I should also underline the fact that there is a wonderful video that we commissioned to show how cinematic Audubon was, comparing new footage, with Audubon's actual watercolors. And for the ivory-billed woodpecker, of course we used the Allen film footage because we don't have any that we could commission.
Curator Roberta Olson. We're talking with her about the New York Historical Society's exhibit, Audubon's Aviary. It's the first part of a 3-year retrospective of Audubon's magnificent watercolors, which he prepared for his famous elephant folio of engravings, The Birds of America. We'll talk more after a break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Roberta Olson, curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society. She's written the text for a sumptuously illustrated book, Audubon's Aviary, the Original Watercolors for the Birds of America, published by Skira Rizzoli. When we left off before the break, we were talking about the video being shown in the exhibit hall, featuring Audubon's watercolors on one side of the split screen, and on the other, the real birds in all their vivid action. That video was so impressive. I saw that at the very end of the exhibition, so I had had the chance to really absorb all the art and, you know, really feel just the direct connection with Audubon. And then to go and to see the plates put right next to, in the video, the birds in their, you know, actually living, it was just so exciting and so effective.
Oh, nice. I'm glad that it was effective, and it really embedded you then, just like Audubon. And that's what he attempts to do. And that's probably why he inspired and still inspires people who are interested in conserving the wilderness, conserving birds, conserving our natural heritage, because they live, and we want them to live. And it is Audubon that really inspires us to keep them as quantities that we can have bird counts for, that we can bring back from DDT, like with the peregrine falcons, with the pelicans, that we can provide this awareness. And I would also like to say something about the passenger pigeon. We do have lots of skins of passenger pigeons, which are still with us. Audubon himself did wonderful scientific things with the birds that I think sometimes are unrecognized. And I'd like to talk about the passenger pigeon as an example of this. He wanted to know how fast they flew, and he didn't have the sophisticated instrumentation that we have today. So what he did was he harvested a passenger pigeon in New York, and he dissected it, and he found a species of rice in its stomach, and he knew exactly where the end growing part in the country, in the Carolinas, of that piece of rice, and he calculated from how much it had been digested how fast that bird flew, and he calculated 60 miles an hour. And one reason his birds are so alive is because he dissected them. He studied anatomy. He knew the ligaments. He knew the muscles. He knew how all the feathers fit. He knew the primaries, the secondaries. He knew everything. And he knew all the different characteristics of the male and the female and the juvenile. And he'd observed them for decades. So what you have before you is knowledge. It's not a flat representation of a profile bird. It is the living bird studied in layers, as an anatomist would.
Now, you also mentioned before that he was a wonderful writer.
He was indeed a gifted writer. And remember that he was writing in his second language. French was his first. And in the exhibition, you can see how his annotations go from things like bleu, gay, instead of blue jay, till he becomes very fluent in English. He wrote beautiful letters, always very quaint, because he would introduce things that were a little bit awkward or were translations of the French, but made him very charming, and he was a very charming person, as well as someone who had, shall we say, great mood swings. He was a controversial person because he was one of these people who walked into a room and everyone paid attention. He had an aura about him. He was magnetic. But he was magnetic in his writings as well. He communicates. He takes you in his writings down his observations. Some of them are tall tales, but most of them have a germ in his reality. And he embeds you in them. He embeds you in the science. He embeds you in the observation. He wrote the Ornithological Biography, which is really kind of the text to the folio plates of the Birds of America on each species. And it was published between 1831 to 39. And he had a wonderful editor, the Scottish ornithologist and university professor, William McGillivray. And Lucy, of course, was also an editor. It is wonderful, absolutely wonderful. His journals, the two that we have left, also make for fabulous reading. And he is someone that you can pick up and read. And some of them are his. He has Tales of the Frontier that he introduces into the Ornithological Biography. Some of them are based on tropes, but most of them, again, have to do with actual experiences. And reading him, I would recommend it for anyone.
Now, this is probably not fair to ask you, because I can see that you are such an Audubon enthusiast that they're probably, it would be hard for you to pick any of your favorites. But I just wonder if you might think of one that pops into your mind that you'd like to leave us with of his wonderful watercolors.
You're asking a mother hen to pick one of her chicks. And for me, it is virtually impossible. But because it is so iconic, I would have to sort of gravitate to the Carolina parakeets for many reasons. Because if we took the glass off of the watercolor in the exhibition, the seven birds that he has drawn in a reverse S-shaped curve have over 10,000 strokes of graphite. He has gone over every barb of every feather, every vein. And then if you take the glass off and you tilt it, they just sparkle. The whole surface scintillates. So these birds, whose call we do not have, all right, we have no footage of them, who died in the early part of the 20th century in captivity and also in the Cincinnati Zoo and also in the wild, are only alive really on Audubon's page on Audubon's watercolor on the J. Wattman paper and in those incredible seven birds, one with 14 tail feathers, that look as though they will fly out at you.
Well, Roberta Olson, thank you so much for talking with us here. This has just been a fascinating conversation and a magnificent production here, not only the exhibition, but this wonderful book, Audubon's Aviary, the original watercolors for the birds of America, and it is put out in a beautiful edition by Skira Rosoli. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Francesca. It's been delightful to talk to you and to meet you.
Roberta Olson is curator of drawings at the New York Historical Society. The exhibit Audubon's Aviary, Part 1 of The Complete Flock, is open until May 19th. So go and see it if you can. Let's take a listen to some of the birds in Audubon's Aviary. The audio was supplied by the Cornell Lab of Ornithology for the video that accompanies the exhibition. First, let's hear the 1935 recording of the ivory-billed woodpecker. The 1935 recording of the ivory-billed woodpecker. Next up, the northern mockingbird. That was the northern mockingbird, and here's the American goldfinch. The American goldfinch, and finally, the tufted titmouse. Those were sounds you can hear while viewing John J. Audubon's magnificent watercolors at the New York Historical Society's exhibit, Audubon's Aviary. Go to writersvoice.net to see some of the paintings on exhibit there. Next up, a new children's book fights childhood obesity. But first, let's listen to Billy Collins' poem, Ornithography.
A poem called that I call Ornithography, which would mean the writings of birds. And I haven't looked this up in the dictionary. It's a pretty new poem, but I'd be surprised and impressed if there were such a word that would describe the writings of birds. And it also has a little epigraph. It came out of a reading that there's a legendary Chinese figure. His name is Kong Yi, I think. And he was said to have invented writing after observing the tracks of birds. So that got it started. Ornithography. A light snow last night, and now the earth falls open to a new page. A cold wind is breaking up the clouds. Children wait for their yellow bus in a huddle. And under the feeder, some birds are busy writing poems, stories, and letters to their mothers. A crow is working on an editorial. That chickadee is compiling a list, and the robin walks back and forth composing the opening to her autobiography. Also prolific this morning, these expressive little creatures, and each with an alphabet of only two letters. A far cry from me, here in silence behind a window, as silent as they are whenever they take to flight, having nothing more to say.
That was Billy Collins reading his poem, Ornithography. Next up, Henry Gets Moving. In 2010, more than one-third of children and adolescents were overweight or obese. Now, a new children's book hopes to spark a community movement to fight childhood obesity by using a cute little hamster named Henry to get kids moving more and eating better. It's called Henry Gets Moving, and I spoke with co-author Chaz Nielsen about the book and the community-based approach it's taking to get kids involved. Chaz Nielsen is a graduate of the University of Massachusetts in Amherst and is going to medical school in the fall of 2013. He wrote Henry Gets Moving with Dr. Pierre Rougier of the University of Massachusetts Health Center, Rougier's son, Pierre, and illustrator Catherine Lazar Odell. Chaz Nielsen, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me.
Henry Gets Moving. This is really a charming book for ages 4 and up, and I have to say I'm way over 4, and I thoroughly enjoyed it as well. This is a book about a little mouse.
Hamster, actually. We know he's a hamster because there is Mickey Mouse and Henry Hamster.
All right. This is a story about a little hamster named Henry. And it's a book really aimed at teaching kids about obesity, controlling obesity, about eating right, and about moving right or moving enough. It's really a book about health for kids. Tell us a little bit about yourself and how did you get involved in this project?
Well, I got involved with this project about a year and a half ago when my friend Pierre Rougier, who is a doctor at UHS, called me and he said, you know, my son came up with this idea to write a children's book about eating healthy and getting exercise. You want to write it with me? And I said, sure. And of course, if I had, like most good things, if I had any idea what it was going to involve, I would have said, no way, I've got other things I want to do. So Pierre's son, Anthony, who is a former UMass football player and now law student down in Florida, one day was walking down the street with his friend, Jack Odell, and they said, you know, there's no good books for kids about eating healthy and exercising. Let's write a children's book. And Jack said, perfect. My sister is an artist. So they started sketching out a character. Catherine, who illustrated the book, came up with the character, Henry Hamster. And they wrote a few pages and didn't really know where to go from there. So I have a writing background. So Pierre contacted me and said, hey, let's write this book. And so, you know, it was a real collaborative effort for about 8 months to put the story and the illustrations together.
And I have to say, the illustrations are just charming. And the book reads very, very well. So let's just go right into Henry Gets Moving. Henry moves. That seems to be the problem that starts, or that's the event that begins his problem. He and his family move to a new location, and it's kind of stressful for him. So talk about the link between stress and obesity. What happens to Henry?
Well, Henry moves to a new town. He doesn't know any children. School hasn't started yet, and he's all by himself. It's something that a lot of children and adults can relate to. So many people have had this uprooting experience in their life. So Henry moves to a new town, and he doesn't know anybody. He's struggling in school. He's struggling on the playground. He's struggling to fit in, and he's getting teased like a lot of children do. And it's with the support of his friend, his family, and his physician that he learns to overcome these things. He doesn't do it alone, and that's a primary theme in our book, is that being healthy is a community activity. It's not this chore that you perform in isolation, but it's something that we do with our friends and our family. It's something that we do as a community. And so that's really the underlying theme in our book, is that being healthy is a community activity.
So he meets another little hamster named Jasmine, who gets him moving. And, well, it's not just about moving, though. It's also about food. And there's a little scene there where they're in the lunchroom, and Henry's got a hot dog and a chocolate chip cookie and a can of soda. What's Jasmine eating?
And Jasmine eats a turkey sandwich, a carton of milk, an oatmeal cookie, and an apple. What we want to do in the book is get kids to recognize what the healthy choices are and to help each other recognize those healthy choices. And this is something that's happening in schools across the country, that there's more and more of an effort to encourage kids to choose healthy, to make healthy choices on their own.
And then Henry goes to the doctor, and the doctor's kind of concerned because he's put on a lot of weight. You say this is a community activity. How do you think kids are going to be able to utilize this book together? How do you hope that they're going to do that?
Well, I can tell you what we've seen so far, and I like to think of this as a family book more than a children's book. You know, it's really a book that's designed to be read with children, not necessarily by children like a lot of children's books are. So there's messages for children and for parents. What I hope to get out of it is I would like Henry to become the national icon for the fight against childhood obesity. I want to hear people on the streets and on playgrounds saying, "Get moving, Henry." You know, I want that to become a national slogan. And I think Henry has an ability to motivate all of us. You know, I know certainly in my life, in Dr. Ruzier's life, in everyone who's been involved in this book, Henry has taken over our lives. Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. But, you know, it's like you have Henry sitting on your shoulder all the time. Perfect example is sometimes, you know, I'll be out to eat and I'll think, oh, I really want a burger and fries. And it's like Henry's just on my shoulder going, well, that's not a very good choice, Chaz.
And it's funny, as I was reading the book, especially the part around moving, you know, I've always been an exerciser, and just over the last few weeks, I've really sloughed off, and Henry was perched on my shoulder saying, you better get moving.
Right. We did a reading down in Agawam, Massachusetts a couple weeks ago. We did this on a Friday, and we had a donor who provided books, so we read to 80 first graders, and then every student went home with a book to read with their family. And on Monday, I got an email from one of the teachers who said, I wanted to let you know what happened today. The students all come to school on Monday, and they start the day by writing about what they did over the weekend. And usually I read things like, I didn't do anything, I watched a movie, I watched TV, I played video games. And last weekend, they all got moving. Kids were walking to the park with their family instead of driving. They were riding bikes. They were going bowling. They were doing all these family activities. And that was so cool to hear, that we read with the kids and then they go instill it in their lives.
You have a campaign for donors to help to get this in the schools. Explain what you're trying to do with this.
So our goal with the book is not to sell it by ones and twos, you know, like any book that's available on Amazon, but what we want to do is to partner with donors who can provide books by the dozens, the hundreds, the thousands, so that we can distribute them for free. And we can give the book to children and to families regardless of their ability to pay, regardless of their ability or their awareness of the book and its message. So we want to partner with college students, with athletes, to read the book with children and to engage children in a conversation about making healthy choices, and then transform this from a fun experience at school to a message that they bring home because donors have provided books for all of the children.
Wow, you're getting athletes involved?
We're trying to. We've done reading events with a number of athletes from UMass. We read with at Hadley Elementary Schools, Hadley, Massachusetts, and the UMass men's hockey team came out to read with all of the first and second and third grade classes. We did an event at the Holyoke Mass Head Start program where the UMass women's tennis team came out. And, you know, ideally we'd like to take this up to a national level where professional sports teams are getting involved. And so we have, you know, these cultural icons who children look up to, reading the book with kids, and distributing books to them.
Well, that's a terrific idea. Have you tried to get to Michelle Obama, who has been has put childhood obesity at the front and center of the work she does?
Well, I mailed Ms. Obama a book shortly before the election. Haven't heard anything back, but that's something we're actively working on. We'd love to coordinate our efforts with hers. I think some of the things that she's doing with Let's Move and some of the efforts by organizations like the NFL, NFL Play 60, those are efforts that are well aligned with ours. And I kind of see Henry as the piece that's missing. Right now, in all these other efforts, there's no icon. There's no character that everyone's rallying around. And so we'd like Henry to be that person, or that hamster.
We're talking with Chaz Nielsen. He co-wrote the book Henry Gets Moving with Pierre Rousier, who is a doctor at the University of Massachusetts. And Chaz himself is about to begin medical school. Now, one of the issues that a lot of people talk about is that it's not just the kids and families' faults that they eat these foods. So many people don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables because they live in what are called food deserts. Fruits and vegetables are far more expensive than the hot dogs and fries and sodas that Henry eats in this book. Do you envision Henry maybe tackling some of the larger social issues and helping to get kids to have more access to healthy choices?
We would love to do that. So one of our goals as authors and, you know, as a company is to be successful enough to support those kinds of efforts. That was a real concern of ours in writing the book, is that we wanted to make sure we weren't writing a story that was only accessible to certain parts of the population. And, you know, I don't know how to solve those problems. I do know to some degree it's an issue that money can solve. And so we would love to be successful enough to help support community wellness movements.
Chaz Nielsen, Dr. Pierre Rousier, and the other members of Henry the Hamster's team are planning sequels to Henry Gets Moving.
Last night, I just finished writing the first draft of a book called Henry Gets Cooking, where Henry and Jasmine decide to turn their neighborhood around and they plant a community garden, and Henry's family teaches cooking classes to the neighborhood, and they transform their local community into, they bring their local community through the same transformation Henry went through.
You also, I forgot to mention that this book is completely bilingual. You have a Spanish translation right along with the English.
Correct. The American society is becoming more and more bilingual, and so we wanted our book to be able to be read by everyone.
You're casting a wide net here. I wonder if you're going to get chefs involved in Henry Gets Cooking.
Great question, and yes. The writing of that book was actually inspired by some discussions with a couple of chefs. The other book that's going to be in the works is Henry Gets Riding, where he learns to ride a bike. Both Pierre and I are avid cyclists, and so when we first started floating drafts of Henry Gets Moving, all of our friends said, there's no bikes in here. And I always had to say, well, that's because we're going to write an entire book about riding bikes.
Oh, that's terrific. And I'm sure you'll have bike safety in there as well.
Of course. Helmets for everyone.
That's great. We've been talking with Chaz Nielsen about the book he co-wrote with Pierre Rougier, who is a doctor. And the book is Henry Gets Moving. I'm sure you're going to be hearing a lot more about the book in the coming months and years. Thanks so much, Chaz, for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
That was Chaz Nielsen. If you want to find out more about the book Henry Gets Moving, go to writersvoice.net for links. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon, at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.